The story of the North Pond Hermit, now the subject of a book called Stranger in the Woods. For years, people who live near North Pond in central Maine found items missing from their summer camps. Not valuable items, but rather things like flashlights, propane tanks, and food. The legend of the North Pond Hermit grew until 2013, when a Maine game warden arrested Christopher Knight during a burglary, after years of trying to track him down. The story captured many people's imagination and went national. Here was a man who had apparently survived 27 years in the Maine woods by himself in a tent. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we interview the author who has written a new book about the North Pond Hermit. Michael Finkel interviewed him several times and spoke with dozens of others affected by him. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Many of us may think or dream about getting away from it all, living closer to nature, but not what Christopher Knight did. He walked into the woods in 1986 and stayed there for 27 years, avoiding people until his arrest in 2013 for burglary. The story captured national attention, and people still talk about it. Today, my guest is an author who is the only journalist to have interviewed Christopher Knight about his time alone in the woods. Michael Finkel is in the studio with me. He's the author of The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. Michael's writing has appeared in National Geographic, GQ, Rolling Stone, Esquire, Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, and The New York Times. His previously published book is True Story, Murder, Memoir, Mea Culpa, which was adapted into a major motion picture in 2015. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the man known as the North Pond Hermit? How closely did you follow the story? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Michael Finkel, the North Pond Hermit, Christopher Knight, apparently walked into the woods when he was 20 years old, and except for once, passing a hiker in the woods and saying hi, he didn't talk to anyone for 27 years. Why did he talk to you?
I think he has good taste in writers. No, it was mostly luck, I would say. You know, not only did Chris Knight spend 27 years alone, it was even more extraordinary than that. He didn't even light a fire once. He kept himself completely isolated. And I read about the story. It was in the Kennebec Journal. And I was really interested in what he would say. And I let a month pass, and he didn't say anything. And I decided to write him a letter. And I did it sort of the old-fashioned way. I thought pen, paper, stamp, envelope. I think maybe some of us remember those things. And I mailed it to the Kennebec County Jail where he was. And he wrote me back. And maybe it was just the simple fact that I put pen to paper really inspired him. In his very first letter, you know, he said, handwritten letters are always personal. And right away I knew from the first paragraph of his first letter that Chris Knight was intelligent. He was sort of witty. He liked literary criticism. And he had a lot to say.
When you started this project, did you know it was going to be a book?
I didn't know what it was going to be. I spend most of my life in Montana. I spend a lot of time in the woods. I did before I had three children. I like to read, and this is a guy who not only spent a lot of time in the woods, he read thousands of books. He was sort of like the world champion of two of my favorite pastimes. And very quickly, though, as we exchanged letters over the course of a summer, I had a feeling that if he shared his story with me, it would have to be told in a large format, like a book.
Okay. So how did he do it? How did he survive 27 years of Maine in the winter? I'm sure you know, those of us who live in Maine year-round have a lot of skepticism.
I don't blame you. I spent 27 years in Montana. I know about winter. I could not pass a single night in Montana in the winter without lighting a fire. So the closer I got to where Chris Knight lived, the less people believed him. They said to me, you know, there's just no way you can go that long without a fire. You can't go 27 years without seeing a doctor. You know, when you put food in the woods, what happens? Animals come and tear your camp apart. And then, of course, you know, there's no way he was out there during the great ice storm of 1988. That's just impossible. He would have frozen to death. So the skepticism was rife. Now, I did have a chance to talk to Chris Knight, and I had a chance to visit his site. And I have to tell you about Chris. He told me that he would either speak to me or he would not speak, but anything he said would be honest. And both of the police officers who arrested him said exactly the same thing, and I hired fact checkers to go over everything, and I went over everything. I have to say, for all the rest of this conversation, that everything I'm going to tell you is almost undoubtedly completely true. He was out there the entire time.
How did he not die of hypothermia?
Yeah, as you said, he went out into the woods at the age of 20, never again got advice from an elder, which is another confounding thing. Let's start with how he didn't freeze to death without lighting a fire. I asked him, oh, you must have just huddled yourself in a sleeping bag and stayed all night. And he said, absolutely wrong. He woke up every night in the winter at like 2:30 in the morning at the depth of cold. And rather than huddling up in blankets, he paced around his camp while he melted snow for water. He never lost a finger or a toe to frostbite. For example, the Great Ice Storm that he mentioned. He loved the Great Ice Storm. It was only like 28 degrees. It was impossible to drive a car, but for him, it was rather warm. He wished there were more. It allowed him to walk in the woods without leaving a footprint. As far as animals ripping your camp apart, he very, very rarely left his camp. And as campers know, and when you're there, animals stay away. He had invented completely on his own ingenious methods of survival, and he did it.
When he was arrested, people had a variety of reactions. One of those reactions was disbelief. Even people that he had robbed from wasn't even sure if he was real. There was this legend, but it was sort of like, are we crazy? Are these kids breaking into our camps? And then there was. The legendary North Pond Hermit existed. You talked with people. Are they still scratching their heads in disbelief?
I mean, 27 years of break-ins. It's like, it was literally got to the point where there was like, you know, it was the Loch Ness Monster and the Himalayan Yeti and the North Pond Hermit. And no one really believed it, but he just put a label on a set of mysterious incidences. And when he was captured, rather than it being sort of like, ah, we understand now, people understood less. The reality was actually stranger than the myth. People could not get their heads around Chris Knight. And I would say the amount of disbelief only was enhanced after his capture.
Why did he do it? Why did he stay 27 years in the woods, and why did he steal from people?
I mean, I think the operative question is why. The how, a lot of the nuts and bolts are in the book, and it's really creative, but he managed to do it. The why is a little complicated, although the answer to the why, I think, is actually kind of simple. Now, most of us, me, you, probably the vast majority of the people listening, will spend very little time alone. In fact, most people, and I think Montana and Maine, are probably more hermity than the average state. But even so, most of us will never spend a single day completely alone. And that means not seeing another person, sending an email, a text, a phone call, not even one day alone. We're sort of afraid of it. Now, throughout history, there have been a few people always, at all times, in all cultures, who have wanted to escape from the world. And Chris Knight is one of them. Why? It's not so much as specific, oh, this happened, I did a crime or something. He felt this internal tug to leave the world. He found a spot in the woods. And the why is this. He was really content. He doesn't like the word happy, but he was really content out there. Yes, he suffered. But when he expressed his contentment, after we wrote letters to each other, I visited him in jail, and there was, you know, there's like a piece of glass between us in the visiting booth, and we were on scratchy phones, and there was a lot of banging going on, but it was uncomfortable to talk to him, but you could see and feel the emotion in his voice when he expressed to me how content he was being completely alone in the woods. And I have to say, Jennifer, that the contentment he expressed is greater than that of a lot of the people I know who are in the world with us.
We're talking with Michael Finkel. His new book is The Stranger in the Woods. It's the story of the North Pond Hermit. Our phone number, if you have a question, 1-800-399-3566. Our email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Michael, I know that you did a lot of investigation into this and talked with psychiatrists. Do you believe that Christopher Knight is sane?
Absolutely. It's at first, everyone, including myself, thought he must be crazy. After receiving his letters and speaking with him, he's highly, highly intelligent. In fact, when I met with him, I was daunted by the power of his mind. In fact, I started to think that he was almost too smart for the world. Psychologists, autism experts, many people weighed in. He's such an outlier that there's really no diagnosis that can be given to him. And it's one of the many sort of mysteries or confounding things or fascinating things. People's reaction to Chris Knight, as you hinted, is all over the map, from respect to hatred, and people's possible diagnoses were everywhere. He's really a unique individual.
What do you think? You mentioned people's reaction to him. Some people obviously were very angry and felt violated by being stolen from or being given a sense of insecurity in their safe place in Maine. Other people, like you said, saw him as some sort of hero. What does this say about us as a society? I'm guessing you think it says more about us than it says about him.
Yeah. I mean, from time to time, you'll hear me speak very warmly about Chris Knight. But he himself would also say, listen, we cannot minimize what he did. He did not hunt and fish for food, though he is an able hunter and fisherman. He took the easy way, which he sometimes compared himself with an animal, and he meant that as sort of a compliment. He liked doing that. He was efficient. He was a master thief. He was able to pick locks. He never broke down a door. He never shattered a window. He never went into someone's full-time home. But the intrusions that he did, he went into people's houses. You know, in some states, you can kill somebody for coming into your house. Stand your ground laws. It is a major crime. You can get 10 years in prison for one break-in, and he did it 1,000 times. So when people told me that they hated him, that it was one of the worst things in their lives, they were correct. I didn't feel that they were wrong at all. And when people said they respected him and wished that they could do something similar, I understood that too. And I think that people's reactions, as you said, to Chris Knight are a really interesting part of the story. They say something about who we are as much as they say something about who Chris is.
Tell us about the warden who caught him in the end.
Yeah, so this 27 years worth of crimes. I mean, something was happening. It's not like it wasn't an alien. There was an explanation. And a game warden named Terry Hughes, law and order man, an amazing woodsman, just decided he had to get to the bottom of it. And without getting lost in the weeds, he worked so hard. He used highly sophisticated classified equipment from Homeland Security. And to make an extremely fascinating story, unfortunately short, he caught the hermit red-handed and was quite angry at him because this is a guy who broke into not only just homes but a summer camp for disabled youth. What kind of a person steals from a summer camp for disabled youth? But after speaking with Christopher Knight for just a little while, Terry Hughes, who's a law and order man to the extreme, really, he said to me he couldn't hate this guy. He knew how smart he was. Immediately, Chris Knight confessed to every crime. He led the officer back to his site. And when Terry Hughes described to me how Chris Knight walked through the woods, I have never seen a police officer do this. Terry Hughes told me that Chris Knight moved like a cat. He didn't break a branch. He didn't leave a footprint. He twisted. He strode. It must have been an amazing piece of performance art that he performed for nobody walking through the woods.
Mike, your own story has made national headlines. You were fired from the New York Times Magazine for fabricating the subject of a story, creating a composite character. So there will be those who are skeptical of your reporting for this book. Why should people trust your reporting here? Because this is a pretty outrageous story.
Yeah, Jennifer, I'm 100% human. I'm a flawed person, as many of us are. And in fact, in one of my very first letters to Chris Knight, I told him, hey, I'm a flawed journalist. I was fired. I've had to come back. And, I think most people, including Chris Knight, I wasn't pretending to be some holier-than-thou journalist. And he himself tried to live a pure existence and had to resort to stealing. And I think he, like most people, have been quite forgiving. Now, as for the truth of this story, I hired not one but two independent fact-checkers to go over everything in this book. This is such an incredible story that there is no room for exaggeration. There's no room for embellishment. If I was 99% sure of something, I'd cut it immediately. Not good enough, I'm telling you. This story is completely true.
Though much of this can't be fact-checked. Much of this is what Christopher Knight told me.
Well, for example, let's say no fire. No one ever saw a tendril of smoke. I examined his site for 8 days. There's not a single piece of charred wood. Any reason or excuse that he had, you know, if it's his opinion, of course, it's in the book. But there was never any shred of evidence that anything he said wasn't true.
But you can't prove a negative. You can't prove he never slept in a cabin. You can't, you know, he didn't break into a cabin and sleep there.
Yeah, I mean, I say this is what he said. Is it possible that he's lying? Wow, it would be like it would almost go against every single bit of his story. He didn't want to talk to me. He did so only because he realized that talking to one journalist would possibly allow him to retreat into peace and tell your story once. You can go and hide again. There was no reason for him to lie. There was no motivation for that. This is a person who was seeking the opposite of notoriety. If anything, he would try and minimize. And again, police officers who are experts, who are used to being lied to, they would also testify that they could not find even the slightest bit of exaggeration on Chris Knight's part.
Where is he now?
So after Chris told me his story, he asked me to leave him alone. We weren't friends. He didn't want to be my friend, and I respected that. He's still in Maine, and I'm hoping that he has managed to carve out a little bit of peace. He's in a very small town where he grew up, and he's more than likely in his family's property, and hopefully has refound a little bit of the contentment that he found in the woods.
Do you worry about him?
Yeah, I'm sort of a worrier by nature. I do. A lot of psychologists told me that, his return to society was obviously traumatic, though Knight himself would say he deserved to be put in jail and was breaking the law. He was raised in a family with rigid morals and knew that what he was doing was wrong. A lot of psychologists said that he was a risk for suicide, and of course I worried about him. It's been a little while now, and I'm hoping that he's found a spot that he's a little more comfortable in.
All right. We're talking with Michael Finkel. He's the author of The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Crossroads, providing gender-responsive addiction treatment for women through their Back Cove Women's Residential Program, crossroadsme.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how addictive drugs were used in Nazi Germany. Soldiers were given methamphetamine to keep them awake during battles. Hitler's doctors gave him oxycodone and cocaine. Some drugs were tested on concentration camp inmates. We talk with Norman Ohler, author of the new book, Blitzed. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Our Maine Public Television Create channel has inspired us to launch our first ever recipe contest. We're partnering with Barber Foods and Southern Maine Community College and are looking for amateur chefs and cooks to put together a fabulous side dish that goes with a chicken entree, made from your own creative original recipe where Maine-grown ingredients are prominent. Recipes will be judged using these criteria: recipe and preparation, use of Maine-grown ingredients, originality and creativity, and visual appeal. The deadline is March 31st. Complete information is online at mainepublic.org. Click on Events and then the Create It Maine Recipe Contest.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the story of Christopher Knight, the man known as the North Pond Hermit. In the studio with me, author Michael Finkel. He's written for a number of national magazines, and this is his second book. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. tweet @MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with Elizabeth, who's calling from Parsonsfield. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm a homesteader, a great-grandmother homesteading who gets a lot of criticism. My trail to my cabin is treacherous, and I have a sign that says, danger, keep out, ice on ledges, so forth and so on. And someone recently said, keep out. She ought to keep out. She shouldn't be living there. Well, I think a lot of people impose their own fear on other people. And I think the Northwoods Hermit is truly an evolved man, escaping the drought. No, well, not escaping. Escaping has an element of negativity to it, but distancing himself from other people's ego and drama, an incredible man. And I wanted to remind people of Diogenes, who lived in the time of Alexander the Great. He decided to assess what people really need in life, which amounted to not too much: liberty, water, clothing, and shelter. And he went to live in a wine vat. And Alexander the Great came to visit him and said, if I weren't Alexander, I'd want to be Diogenes. And he asked Diogenes what he could give him as a gift and appreciation for his inspiration. And Diogenes said, just move a little to the side. You're blocking the sun. But anyway, I just wanted to make those few little comments.
Elizabeth, thanks for calling. This is exactly what we were talking about, isn't it, Mike? How people's perception of the hermit is very different.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you said. First of all, Diogenes is the person, if you know the tarot card deck, he's the person who's portrayed on the hermit tarot card. And one thing that you said, you know, at least, I don't know, twice a day when I'm driving around, I got two kids crying in the back seat, a text coming in, late to an appointment, stuck in traffic. This little thought flashes through my head. You know, maybe it's not Chris Knight who's crazy, but perhaps it's the rest of us.
Elizabeth, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Howland and Billy. Hi, Billy. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing? Very interesting today. I just wanted to know if you could give us an update on the hermit and if he's receiving any of the proceeds from the book. Thanks, and I'll take my answer up here.
Chris Knight didn't want anything in return. I did actually offer to help fund him, and he said no. One of his main victims was the Pine Tree Camp in Rome, Maine, and I've been donating to them, and I encourage anyone who wants to help out Chris Knight to instead think about giving to the Pine Tree Camp in Rome, Maine.
We have a tweet. Didn't Chris mention his plan to family or friends before departing? Was he a missing person?
He mentioned his plan to no one. We didn't talk about his family. His family suffered. He never called them. He didn't send a postcard. His belief in solitude was such that one note, one call, and there's a connection, and a single connection is not solitude. They did not file a missing persons report, although several police officers I spoke with up there said that wasn't surprising. He comes from a very private, keep-to-themselves family. But I spoke to many friends of the family who said, of course, they were worried. They had no idea what happened to Chris. His father died 15 years after he completely disappeared, and he was still listed as a survivor in the obituary.
We're going to go to Clayton, who's calling from Guilford. Hi, Clayton. Go ahead. You're on the air with Michael Finkel.
Yeah, thanks. I was just wondering if in all those years that he spent in the wilderness, if he didn't incur any serious injuries. I mean, living on your own in the wilderness, there had to be some times that then you watch those shows, those, you know, survivor shows where they're incurring injuries all the time. So did anything like that ever happen?
I think that's a great question. I actually injured myself walking through those woods. They're so difficult, covered with slick rocks. Chris wore glasses. And he said that if he broke his glasses, he'd really be stuck. And he was so cautious about not breaking his glasses. And he said to me, I used that cautiousness and applied it to my entire body. He is blessed with not only a really highly functioning mind, but also extreme physical coordination. Yes, he tumbled a few times. He never broke a bone. He never had a serious illness. It's one of the other one of the many extraordinary aspects of this story.
All right. Thanks, Clayton, for the question. How about Nick in North Berwick? Hi, Nick. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, thanks for answering my call. I love the show. I was just curious. I mean, most people who go out into the woods make fires because it provides comfort, et cetera. And, you know, even if you're worried about smoke during the, you know, smoke being seen, you can make a fire that's not too smoky. And I just wonder why he didn't take part in that, because it would provide comfort. You know, there's certainly ways where you can make barriers so that it can't be seen from a distance, et cetera. So I'm just curious why he would go, why would he would deny himself that sort of pleasure, both comfort-wise and just experience-wise.
Nick, Chris's campsite was really close to other homes. If you knew exactly where you were going, you could get to the nearest cabin in 3 minutes. There were about 300 cabins around. He was so dedicated to extreme solitude that he never left one footprint he thought was too many, and one tendril of smoke was too much. He had decided he would rather die in the woods than be discovered.
Nick, thanks for your question. We'll move on to Portland and Elias. Hi, Elias. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks. I guess my question is tangentially related to the gentleman just before mine. He said he didn't make any fires to warm himself or cook his food or anything. But yet we hear about him also stealing things like propane tanks and that kind of thing. Is that how he kept warm and cooked his food, since propane is smokeless? Was there some other way that he prepared his food, et cetera?
Yeah, he stole a Coleman two-burner camp stove, and he stole several propane tanks. He used most of the propane during winter to melt snow to have drinking water, and he cooked a little bit. But as he told me, cooking was too kind a word for what he did. He stole basically from the pantries of cabins, ate a lot of macaroni and cheese. But he didn't use the propane to keep warm. You know, obviously burning propane in an enclosed tent is a bad idea. He had ingenious systems. I won't get into it for keeping himself alive and never lost a finger or toe to frostbite.
All right, Elias, thanks for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Michael, do you think that there's a risk of romanticizing the story?
I mean, absolutely. Some people do romanticize it. I heard one of the callers call Chris Knight an evolved being, and I think that one of the aspects of this story that I find really intriguing is the range of emotions from, you know, romanticizing Chris Knight to demonizing him, and I think it's that range of reactions that again enriches the complexity of the story.
All right. And I also wanted to ask you, what do you think would have happened to him if he weren't arrested?
He basically told me that, you know, he went in at 20 and was arrested when he was 47. And despite being an extraordinary woodsman, time affects us all, no matter how much you deny it. And he was getting older. He told me that he was going to never emerge from the woods voluntarily, that he might die in the woods, not having ever taken a photo, left a single message, no Facebook posts, no tweets. He would just die in his tent, and nature as it does would consume his tent and his body and eventually his propane tanks, and he would leave no trace of his existence.
Did he expect to be caught?
He said that he sensed the circle closing in. It's sort of like technology was hurting him. He knew that cameras were placed around, and at first he could sort of remove the card from the camera. He didn't want to damage anyone's valuable stuff, but he would remove the card, and then they got really smaller and well hidden. And he sensed, as he put it to me, that the circle was closing in.
Hmm. We're going to go to Roy, who's calling from Belfast. Hi, Roy. Go ahead.
Hey, I just tuned in, so I'm not sure if this question has been answered. But my concern is that he's being glorified for living this type of lifestyle. And my exception is that my family has a property on Little North Pond, not far from where his campsite was. And they were denied safe use of their camp because of fear of him. And he was around their cabin and seen outside in the evenings on a couple occasions. And he also stole from them on a regular basis. And so I'm glad he's not getting any profits from the book. But at the same time, I don't agree with the glorification of his lifestyle because he didn't do it on his own. He did it by stealing from other people.
Yeah, I think your concerns are entirely valid. There were people who told me that their kids had nightmares. They could not stay in their own cabin. They spent their hard-earned money to find a place where they can escape the pressures of life, only to have a person come in the night. How are they supposed to know he wasn't armed? How are they supposed to know he was a gentleman? I mean, he tortured some people, and I never want to minimize that. Your concerns are completely valid. But his story is also quite extraordinary, and other people feel differently. But I, in the book itself, don't shy away from opinions like yours, and you're absolutely correct.
Roy, thanks for calling. I'm going to go to an email from Jamie. When I first heard about Chris Knight, I was personally intrigued by his choice of living and had to feel some amazement for his ability to go largely undetected. I worked spring and summer throughout Maine as a biologist in the 90s and early 2000s, so I understand how little time the masses actually spend in the woods. That fact would have helped Chris. I spend several weeks a year backpacking less popular hiking trails, and I've had the good fortune of hiking for up to a week without seeing or talking to another person. Contentment really does describe the feeling one can get from that. It is an antidote to the craziness of contemporary culture. We'll go to Portland and Lyle. Hi, Lyle. Go ahead.
Hi there. Two quick questions. How did Chris manage the waste? And I'm not just certainly body waste. If he's that close to other places, I wonder about that. But particularly waste like cans and paper waste, packaging waste. The second question I have is, how did he manage to hide his tracks when it snowed?
Both excellent questions. When I, as a camper myself, I was really interested in the nuts and bolts like that. He dug a pit toilet for human waste and for packaging, and mostly the food waste and the propane tanks. He dug a very deep garbage pit, which he carefully buried layers of dirt over. It didn't smell at all. Some people claimed that he was soiling a beautiful part of the woods, but I would say that after 27 years, if any of us made a pile of all our garbage, it would be 1,000 times bigger than Knight's. What was the second question?
How did he avoid leaving tracks in the snow?
Great question. There were times. He compared himself to an animal right before winter came. He would go on a extended – he would try and fatten himself up, and by doing that, he went on an extended run of thieving, trying to stock his camp up. Ideally, he would never leave his tiny camp in the woods for 6 months, from the first snows in November to thaw in April, because you can't go in the snow without leaving a track. However, there were a few emergency times where he was completely out of food and at the brink of starving to death, in which case he had radios, he stole radios, he monitored the weather exhaustively, and when a big storm was right on the cusp of coming, he would go out, he'd usually cut across the frozen pond, steal some food, and come back as it started to snow and his tracks were covered over.
Lyle, thanks for your call. Those are good questions. Everywhere you go, Michael, are people asking you these questions? Does this seem to be the fascination, the how did he do it?
Well, I shared exactly these questions. You know, they were in my own mind. And, you know, when someone lives a life that much of an outlier, there's curiosity. And also, you know, throughout history, the rest of us, have been curious as to what, why, and how did these people who sort of observed us from a distance, what do they have to say about the rest of us? It's a primal fascination.
All right. The phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Have to take one more break. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Farmland Trust, member-powered and working hard to grow a bright future for farming in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org.
Here's how the mayor of one Texas city describes the decision to go 100% renewable.
Because it's our love of green, green rectangles and green energy.
Green rectangles meaning dollar bills.
Yes.
That's in spite of the small city's conservative leanings.
I don't think they're ever going to accuse Georgetown of being the next Berkeley.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How one Texas city played against type and decided to go green. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And All Things Considered gets underway this afternoon at 4 o'clock. And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for World Affairs, a look at how U.S. defense, intelligence, diplomatic, and development agencies are working to prevent the rise of violent extremism and to counter ISIS. World Affairs coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what does it take to live alone in the woods for more than 25 years? The story of the North Pond Hermit. In the studio with me, Michael Finkel. He is the author of a book that's just been published. Its title is The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Mike, do you think that he is the, you know, as journalists, you're always looking for superlatives. Is this the longest known person in modern times to live alone in a northern woods?
So when working on this project, I wanted to, you know, I wanted to write about Chris Knight, but I also wanted to write about hermits who spent an equal amount of time by themselves. So I started reading the literature of solitude, which is immense. We've been writing about hermits since we've been writing. You know, recorded history goes back 5,000 years. Some of the first documents that exist are about wild men or loners or shamans living in the woods. And I started looking. You know, I looked in religious hermits. I looked at hermits who left because they hated society, protesters. And I read and read and read. This is a little crazy, but I spent like a year of my life doing nothing but reading about hermits and hired several researchers to help me. And my conclusion, as crazy as this is, as hard as this is to get your head around, I really feel I can make a very strong case that there has been no known, it's possible there's unknown, no known person in all of human history who has been quite as secluded as Christopher Knight.
Well, and that's related to an email we have here from Todd in Scarborough. He writes, I'm hearing the term wilderness repeated when talking about the subject. I'm not too familiar with the area where Knight lived, but when I look on an online map, it appears his camp was located between state highways and Interstate 95. How close to I-95 and population centers did he live?
Yeah, he didn't live in the Great North Woods. He lived basically in Rome, near the town of Rome in rural Maine. He was just in a very thick patch of forest. He was on private property. He was trespassing all 10,000 of his nights. So I talked to the owner of the property, and I wondered what she would say. And when she was informed that a man had been living on her property uninvited for 25 years, here was her reaction. She said, so what? If I'd have found him, I might have let him stay.
And even though on a map it looks like it was close to highways, you've been to the location and you say it is very secluded, yeah?
Yeah, I'm used to hiking in the woods of Montana where it's a lodgepole forest. The trees are wide open. You could see distances. I have never – maybe there's lots of forests like this in Maine, but I've never experienced a forest as thick and as difficult to move through. There's no trails. A lot of the trees are quite skinny, and then it's just chocked with those glacier-deposited boulders that are carpeted with moss. I sounded like a bull in a china shop trying to walk through it. It was, though it's only on a small property, I was never so disoriented and also felt claustrophobic in the woods. I couldn't believe that no one had stumbled across his site for a quarter century until I went into the woods. It's really amazingly thick.
We're going to go to Jimmy, who's calling from Orono. Hi, Jimmy. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Great show, as always. Mr. Finkel, two questions. Why, given all that you just said, why didn't he go somewhere more remote where he could have fires and be more relaxed and not get on cameras eventually? And second question, how would you compare him to Ted Kaczynski? Thank you.
Yeah, Chris actually grew up in a family and is an able hunter and fisherman. And I guess the possibility of him going to the North Woods existed. But he's a pretty smart guy. And I think he realized that it is virtually impossible to live on your own in a place like Maine or Montana where it's very difficult to feed yourself in winter. And he realized that he would probably die. There's really no one that could live years and years completely by themselves. Even ancient humans that came here had, you know, we hunted in bands and groups. No one did it solo. So I think in his mind, he realized that his best chance, perversely, of actually being completely alone was being near other people. And he found this sort of perfect spot, thick woods, a lot of second homes, not too crowded, not too remote, and he made it work. I see very little connection between Chris Knight and Ted Kaczynski. Ted Kaczynski murdered some people, hated society. Chris Knight said he had really no opinion of society. He did this for himself. Ted Kaczynski was actually shouting at society while Chris Knight was hiding from it.
Thanks, Jimmy, for your call. We're going to go to Zach, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Zach. Go ahead.
Hi. In one of the photographs online, there's a television in his sight. I wonder to what extent did he stay up to date on what was going on in society? And did he steal newspapers and magazines, for example? And if so, what interested him?
He stole a tiny little, I think it's like a 4-inch black and white television early in his hermitage. And he said it just took too many batteries to keep it running. And the last thing he saw on TV, I think, was after the September 11th terrorist attack and then never used it again. He stole a lot of magazines. He always had a radio, so he was very well – he was up to date with the news. He wasn't particularly interested in what was going on in the outside world. It was sort of a form of entertainment. He preferred music, but he was aware – and if there was any subject that really interested him, he said it was war. He wanted to know where we were killing each other.
We'll move on to Lewiston and Don. Hi, Don. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I think you answered one of my questions about why he didn't move around more, because it seems like that would avoid detection. But it sounded like he thought he'd found the perfect place. And my second question was, how come he didn't build a more permanent structure to live in besides a tent? I mean, like, you can do that very, efficiently and keep it well hidden. I mean, I've had to do it before when I've gotten stuck in the woods just to build, you know, with boughs and branches, and it's really quite a lot warmer than a tent. And if I was going to live someplace for 27 years, I think I'd want a more permanent structure than a tent.
Yeah, I think we'd all do things a little different. I would light a fire, of course. His structure wasn't bad. It was constructed mostly of tarps, but it was completely waterproof. And he invented a system so that he didn't – I was not going to say he kept warm, but he didn't freeze to death. And as for your question about whether he would or comment about whether he would move, he kept a hidden cache about 200 feet from his site where there was a tent, sleeping bags, very minimal cooking supplies so that if someone discovered his site, and Chris would know in advance because people walk through those woods with a lot of noise except for night, and he could abandon his site, get stuff out of his cache, and move. That's how committed he was to isolation. He didn't have to do that, but he was prepared.
Don, thanks for your call. We have an email from Jack. He writes, "It is not true, as the author says, that the hermit never broke down a door or damaged camps. He pried the screen off a window, breaking it, then damaged the window to get it open. He then left by breaking my deadbolt, bolted door with my crowbar. I got partial restitution for this."
Yeah, he. I didn't want to imply that there was no damage at all. Certainly he damaged locks and I think screens, as was mentioned. I don't think he kicked down a door. He picked a lock or damaged it. I don't think he shattered a window ever. If he couldn't get in by a door or a window, I think he would try a different cabin. But there was some damage for sure.
I'm going to go to Mark, who's calling from Winslow. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Love the show. My question is, having been broken into and robbed 11 to 12 years ago, I still feel violated. It seems like they're deifying Mr. Knight. I'm wondering how much of the profits from Mr. Finkel's book is going to compensate the people who still have this violation that they're experiencing.
Yeah, so the I decided that, you know, Chris Knight himself is receiving nothing from the book, and the Pine Tree Camp was Knight's chief victim, and they have a really beautiful program there. They have a summer camp for children and adults with disabilities, physical and mental, and I've been sending some of my proceeds there. There was a little restitution fund, but for the most part, most homeowners are not receiving anything.
Thanks, Mark. Going to Sam, the discussion has – this is an email. The discussion has been directed as to how, but I'm intrigued as to why. I'm 21 years old, close to the age of Chris when he entered solitude, and I can't imagine leaving life behind. Why did he decide to make this decision? And we did talk about this a little bit, but this is kind of a different perspective. I mean, 20 is kind of an unusual age.
Yeah, one of the questions that this story brought up to me is, what do we do with people who don't fit into the rest of the world? Now, if you're a murderer, we put you in jail. If you're clearly mentally insane, we have therapy and we have programs for that. But what about someone who's sane and yet still just doesn't fit in? We don't know what to do with someone like that, and we haven't figured it out. And it's one of the things that I think about. Knight tried to solve it on his own, and as he told me, he wished that he didn't have to break the law to find a place on this planet that sort of would accommodate him. But he did, and he did find a spot, but it didn't quite work out.
Barry writes on Facebook, did the author interview any siblings or family that can shed light on Chris's choices?
Chris Knight comes from a very private family, and I asked to speak with his family, but they didn't. I spoke with many of his family's friends, acquaintances, his school teachers. He comes from a really interesting family, certainly not very well-to-do family in central Maine, and yet they were the type of family that in the evening they would read Shakespeare and poetry, but in the day they would all learn how to fix cars, automotive, electric. They built buildings. They were very self-sufficient and highly educated. All of the boys in his family, he has four brothers, were extremely good students, extremely bright.
We'll go to Linda, who's calling from Unity. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I'm curious about his inner life. What kind of books did he read? Did he have intellectual, psychological, emotional interests that you could pick up by talking with him or finding out about the books he read? Did he have spiritual inclinations? I don't mean religious necessarily, but inner life dynamics. I don't even think any of those things indicate romanticizing somebody. I think that kind of person exists, maybe not living so extremely, but, you know, needing to be away from the world.
Yeah, as an avid reader myself, I liked talking with Chris about literature, and he liked talking about that as well. You know, the closest human relationships I sometimes feel he had were the ones that exist between the pages of a book. And when I find a book that I like, I can sort of lose the rest of the world and tumble into it. And he certainly was able to do that. You know, specific books that he mentioned, he really liked Shakespeare. He loved military history. He liked the poems of fellow Mainer Edna St. Vincent Millay. But as he told me, his book's choice was limited by what he could steal in the cabins of North Pond. So he ended up reading a lot of Potboilers and Stephen King novels and things like that. And he said that that was all fine, but he did have very specific desires, and sometimes he was able to fulfill them and sometimes not.
Thanks, Linda. We'll go to Laura, who's calling from Massachusetts. Hi, Laura. Go ahead. Laura, go ahead. Are you there? Shoot. Okay, so we'll go to Barbara, who's calling from Rome. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a few statements about how I've lived in this area since 96. One of the things I do is take care of second homes. And I also hike and snowshoe and cross-country ski across Foss Hill, which is the area where he was camping out. And I just want to say numerous times I came across setups where he had left them. The tarp situations could be found. There was usually mattresses pulled in from who knows where. And, yeah, he did leave it kind of trashed. But at the same time, Fossville was also a dumping ground for people to dump their trash, so it wasn't like his trash was any different than other trash that had been put up there. And he did move more than once. He didn't live in that same spot for 27 years. I want to say in my 20 years in this area, I probably came across at least three different sites where he had lived at one point in time and for whatever reason had moved to a different location. One incident was when I remember canoeing down Meadowbrook Stream. I used to take kayaking and canoeing trips down with other people, and one time I stopped and pulled off to the side to get up on the shore to go to the bathroom, and sure enough, I found a trail and it took me right to where he was located. The following year, and I think it was 2009, was when they determined that milfoil was in the area, and sure enough, his campsite had been broken down at that point in time, and that's, I think, when he moved over to the spot where they found him at.
And what year was that, Barbara?
2009 was the year they found the milfoil.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also the week before they determined milfoil was there and stopped people from using the stream, was, again, I had stopped in that same location, and sure enough, his whole camp had been taken down. There was just a few ripped tarps that were left behind.
Okay, we're almost out of time. I want to give Mike a chance to respond.
Oh, yeah, Knight told me before he settled into his spot that he tried six or seven spots in the area, and I found a couple of them. With a few others, it was sort of hard to tell if it was Knight's site or not. As you mentioned, other people dumped things there. But, yeah, in the effort to compress the story into the limited time, yeah, he moved around a few times before he settled into his site. So you're absolutely right. There are other Knight campsites, but he lived in his final one for the last 25 years of his hermitage. The first 2 years, he moved around a lot.
Barbara, thanks for your call. Michael, thank you for joining us today. Michael Finkel's new book is called The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. Michael has a number of readings and events coming up throughout the state this week. Visit our website or Facebook page for details. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me and the Maine Calling tech team to get answers to your laptop, tablet, smartphone, and smart home device questions. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.